Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this incredible and very special Melbourne Writers Festival special podcast. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge that we're recording this on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri and Boon Wurrung peoples of the Kulin Nations. I'd like to extend my respects to their elders past, present, and emerging, and I'd like to extend that respect to any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander listeners who may be tuning in today. It is always, of course, a pleasure and a joy to be coming together to celebrate and discuss storytelling, especially from a land that has seen over 60,000 years of storytelling. But of course, part of that is also a responsibility to recognize and seek redress for the ongoing ramifications of colonization, which are ongoing. This land was never ceded, and it will always be Aboriginal land. So, hello, hello. My name is Adolfo Ranwez. I am a writer, editor, dancer, all-around busy person. Hopefully you know who I am. If not, check my work out. But today is not about me. Today is about two incredible authors who are here with me. First off, we've got Dr. Eve Reese, the author of All About Eve, Notes from a Transition. They are a writer and historian, a history lecturer at La Trobe University, and co-host of the Archive Fever podcast. What a title. I imagine that's a reference to Nabokov. If not, well, I have just made it a reference to Nabokov, which is wonderful.
From Derrida. Derrida.
Actually. Oh, Derrida. Got it.
Yeah.
Similar caliber of reference. Very pretentious. What are we doing? This is not about pretension.
Yeah. Nabokov, Derrida, all the same, really. Yeah.
And also we have Madeline Ryan, the author of A Room Called Earth, a director and a writer who has penned for The New York Times, SBS, Vogue, The Sydney Morning Herald, Vice, and Bustle, among others. Hello, Taylor, to you both.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yeah.
So just a bit of a rapid fire summary. Today we'll be talking about two quite different works, one a memoir and one a novel, but both of them offer a rare and riveting glimpse into the life and mind of a very unique individual. So the two of you. We'll be discussing not just the works themselves, but also the people who wrote them, and of course the worlds in which they were written. I've structured this into three parts, completely alliterative because of who I am as a person. It's my signature. So it's plot, person, and propulsion, because we're talking about being out in the world. And we'll punctuate, oh my God, another P, those three sections with two short reading. Cool. All right, we're going to get into it. So part one, plot. So this is, after all, a writer's festival event. So let's begin with the works themselves. Could you each tell me about the journey from ideas to page to print? Maybe Madeline, we'll start with you. How did you devise the character of the unnamed narrator? You know, like where did the setups and the settings come from? This idea of, you know, getting ready for a party. It's so beautiful and unique.
Yeah, it was really a dance between where she wanted to go and what she wanted to think and what she wanted to do. And then kind of occasionally me tapping in, I guess, as the writer, kind of monitoring that process very loosely. But a huge part of it was like I'd been through, I think, lots of life changes before I sort of started hearing her voice, I guess. And then it was about continuing to listen to her voice, continuing to write it down and just seeing, yeah, where she led me and where she wanted to go. Because I, you know, every time I tried to force something, like my own idea onto something, I'd be like, because obviously it all takes place over one night. Yeah, she gets ready for the party. She goes to the party. She returns from the party. She has different experiences and encounters. But occasionally I'd be like, so do you like want to go somewhere else? Do you want to go a week ahead? Do you want to go anywhere else? And it was just like, no, this moment and everything that I'm thinking, everything that I'm feeling, everything that I'm seeing, and then the next moment. And interestingly, I discovered when I allowed her to just be in the present moment, it would tap into her past or tap into her hopes for the future or, you know, her physical sensations or what she was seeing and her, you know, judgments of that or her, you know, analysis of that and trying to work it out. And it was a very multifaceted thing when you went moment by moment. So in terms of sort of structure and plot, I kind of allowed her to tell me where to go, I guess, and just trusted that. Sort of intuitive for me, I think. Yeah.
Such a beautifully empowering idea, letting a character you know, command you almost. And Eve, where, I mean, yours is autobiographical. So were there, you know, any specific difficulties involved in recounting your own life for, you know, a very broad audience? I mean, for example, how did you even pick which life milestones to include?
Yeah, I mean, there were so many difficulties and challenges. It's kind of hard to know where to begin. I suppose my main consideration in kind of structuring the book and plotting it out was that I wanted to resist the conventions of trans memoir as they exist at the moment, which is a kind of a big focus on, you know, childhood and feeling dysphoric and an outsider in childhood and, you know, childhood trauma, and then kind of leading up to a moment of gender transition and then that kind of fixing the problem. I was very aware of that as a kind of established trans script. And it really dates back to the 1930s when Lily Elba, one of the first kind of prominent trans women whose story was later made into the film The Danish Girl, when she wrote her life story. So there was a kind of very established narrative of how trans memoir works. And there are a lot of political and kind of medical reasons for that. But I was really conscious of the limitations of that genre and that storytelling arc. And also the way in which my own story didn't fit into it. You know, in so many ways, I'm not a typical trans person. I didn't consciously realize I was trans as a kid. I didn't have a kind of strong sense of being born in the wrong body. I didn't want to medically transition to the other side of the binary. I didn't want to live stealth, you know, as a trans man, which is sort of the common narrative of how an assigned female person is meant to want to inhabit their transness. So I suppose the combination of feeling a bit limited by the conventions of trans memoir and my own failure to conform to those conventions made me want to kind of experiment a bit with writing against that. So in writing the book, I deliberately didn't write very much about my childhood or my early life. There's only really one chapter on that. And most of the book is kind of in the messiness of the last 3 years of transition. And I wanted to, I suppose, just sit in that messiness and, to the extent I could, refuse the temptations of resolution to kind of tell a, you know, neat transition story of I, you know, got my medical transition, I got fixed and now I'm fine. I wanted to bring readers into that complexity and to emphasize that there is no easy resolution, that complexity is ongoing, and I'll be, you know, transitioning my gender, I'll be becoming my gender as we all become ourselves on a lifelong basis until I die.
So I love that you've actually jumped into the point that I wanted to discuss next, which is about style, because of course, you know, a piece of literature works best when substance and style work hand in hand together. So Eve, just building on that point, you've talked about resisting conventions, you know, when it comes to trans memoir. And one thing that particularly tickled my fancy with your book is the frequent intertextual references. Could you talk us through the decision behind that?
I think there are a few factors that led to that decision. One is that it sort of emulates, I suppose, the writers I admire. I'm really impressed by and influenced by, I suppose, what I'd describe as a kind of contemporary American tradition of creative nonfiction and essay writing. People like Gia Tolentino and Yul Abyss, people, you know, have written for The New Yorker and written books of essays. And I really love the way they combine the kind of the intimacy of an individual life and often quite everyday, mundane, embodied moments with more meta, political, cultural, sociological, historical analysis, and draw upon different texts to do that. I think it's how we think as individuals, or certainly how I think. But also I love the way it kind of reclaims the domain of the personal and the embodied from, you know, as it was long seen as a kind of frivolous, feminized, trivial domain, to sort of show how intimately that is tied in with our biggest political questions. So that was one consideration. It's also how I'm trained to think as a historian, which is, you know, my day job, and I've been working as a historian my entire adult life. That really, I recognize, trains to lead me to see individual lives, I suppose, within the broader arc of history and the kind of political and cultural context of their time. So that's how I really understood my own life and my own transition. And I suppose the third kind of impulse behind that intertextuality was that I discovered my own transness through trans writers and filmmakers and artists. And they were so powerful for me in terms of, you know, for the first time, finding a language and a conceptual framework to understand the sense of wrongness and kind of otherness I'd always felt. As I write in the book, it wasn't until my late 20s that I really had a language to articulate that. And that came from the kind of explosion of trans culture we've seen in the last decade. So I wanted to pay homage to that culture, really, and to honour it and to introduce readers to it and to kind of be in conversation with it to show how it had influenced my own thinking.
And Madeline, speaking of the intimacy of everyday life and also challenging convention, A Room Called Earth is, you know, an expertly executed, unconventional piece of fiction in that, you know, you kind of almost eschew this idea of having a conflict, a central conflict or a series of actions, you know, like if we're going back to creative writing 101, you know, like that's almost put aside in your work, focusing instead on interiority and the challenges that a person faces before acting. Could you talk us through that process and that those stylistic decisions?
Yeah, I guess sort of related to what I was saying before, often going to the heart of a moment or an experience had its own climax, beginning, middle, end quality to it and would find its own moment of like breakthrough or awakening or a lack of clarity, like what you've been talking about, Eve, or, you know, it's interesting how like she would go into a thought about a previous experience in relation to the current experience, but then you'd get this kind of multidimensional understanding of the present moment that would then have unexpected twists and turns in terms of how she drew the patterns together or how the past enabled her to try and understand the present. It's like, yeah, I suppose it is quite unconventional, but in so many ways I can see on all different scales, the conventions that are encouraged or taught, although I went through a huge process of just finding all of that incredibly stifling and sort of having to just throw it away and not think about it for a really long time before I came to this to kind of clear the slate and just start from what felt like her voice and like a blank space. But in terms of what you were saying too about all the texts that you brought into your work, Eve, and that sense of how what we read influences us personally, even though it's something I don't necessarily believe in things being inside or outside of us, which you could probably imagine given what I've written, but it's sort of all like part of this one experience or entity that is life. But those things that we read and what they mean for our identity or how we see others, our bodies, whatever it is, all of that creates incredible tension in relation to, like, if you bring in all of that and then you have a character meeting another character, it's like, well, how's that going to go down? Given all the things we know this person's read and what they believe and how they relate to, you know, the opposite sex or themselves or just on any level. And it's like, how do people even connect when we have all these different things influencing us in any given moment and ideas about, you know, what to say or what not to say or how we feel, or should we, you know, express how we feel? It's like I see constant sort of, I mean, I can't think of another word, but like climaxes in everything, even if it's very small as a moment. So although it throws away convention, I guess, on the surface in a lot of ways, I feel like those conventions are all in there, like a little glittering web at the same time.
Such beautiful thoughts to leave us with. As I invite you, perhaps Madeline, to give us a little snippet of your book, please.
Ooh, yes, yes. So the chapters in my book are quite short. So this is a chapter 36. I wonder where the fucking bathroom is. Going to the bathroom is always a bit of a thing in situations like this. My focus has to become spatial rather than social. I have to figure out where the toilet is based on the sense of the environment that I have so far, which requires a different part of my brain. It's nice to have something tangible to work out, though. Now that I have to go to the bathroom, I can walk through the different rooms of the house with a sense of purpose. Whereas when I haven't had to go to the bathroom, I've had to walk around pretending like I've got something tangible to do in order to seem purposeful. idleness or appearing to be lost or alone, or like you're just reflecting upon something, isn't valued in social environments. Even standing still for a tad too long or just noticing the fact of existing is considered to be distinctly unproductive and antisocial. It implies that we haven't been chosen. When we're busy, we've been chosen. Someone or something wants our attention. Being in a state of oversaturation or overwhelm suggests that we have a tribe and that we fit in, and that our attention is going towards something outside of us and that we belong. Focusing on our inner world has no social currency. I mean, no one is standing around waiting to congratulate us for stopping to feel how we feel and to consider what we want and to question why we choose to behave in certain ways. If anything, our doing this makes others uncomfortable. However, I've noticed that when I treat my inner world as sacred, every interaction that I have with the outside world becomes sacred too. How I treat myself is a reflection of how I treat the world and, in turn, how the world treats me. Nevertheless, I make sure to adapt in social environments and to do everything I can to shift myself into a purposeful, energetic, outwardly oriented space because I know it serves the neuroses of the people around me. It's important to acknowledge the process of adapting too. Otherwise, I'd have nothing of my own at all and I'd just become an adaptation, a mindless shadow following everyone else around. So when I acknowledge the choice to adapt, I've consciously chosen a course of action and exercised my greatest power as a human being, choice. I'm choosing this. I'm choosing this. I don't have to choose this. I'm choosing this.
Ah, such a beautiful distillation of almost the clash. I mean, I know, again, you've said, Madeline, you don't like the idea of in and out necessarily, but, you know, it does highlight that clash between so-called in and so-called out, or so-called, you know, self and so-called world. Eve, on that note, you brought up the idea of a script before, like transcript, not transcript, like script for trans people. Although interestingly sounds the same. So I think that's the perfect jumping off point to move into section two, person, as in the two of you. And I am curious, you know, this idea of a script, so correctness or appropriateness, normalcy, these are things that plague those of us who are in one way or another minoritized or seen as other. So maybe you first, Eve, how have you navigated others' expectations of you as a so-called other, as a trans person?
Well, I suppose when I first came out as trans, I was extremely naive about what that would entail. And I suppose I naively saw it as a kind of ticket to liberation from gender rules and gender norms. And what I very quickly discovered is that that is not the case, that there are just as rigorous gender norms and scripts and expectations and everything that adhere to trans lives and trans experience as for cisgender people. And that was really frustrating and confronting for me. You know, this is particularly true of the medical context, and I think largely reinforced by the medicalization of transness, which, you know, creates this very narrow binary model of what transness and gender nonconformity and gender diversity is meant to look like. And trans people are often subtly or not so subtly kind of encouraged to mold their experience to fit those narratives to access the gender-affirming healthcare that they need. And that was certainly my experience when I first went to a gender clinic and saw a psychologist and found that, you know, what I thought was going to be a kind of, let's just talk about my gender and like feel some feelings about it and be creative and explore, was just really trying to slot me into a box. It was trying to, you know, give me literally a numerical diagnosis of gender dysphoria to work out how trans I was, whether I was trans enough to get treatment. And, you know, it turns out because I'm, you know, I like getting A pluses on things, it was quite validating that I did get a high score of gender dysphoria. But I was really disenchanted with that whole process. And I suppose it, you know, led me on this path of, you know, reading a lot about the history of transness and its medicalization and trying to understand why it's so restrictive. I think in a settler colonial context like Australia or so-called Australia, it's important also to keep in mind that this kind of insistence on in putting people into boxes, even trans people who've notionally kind of escaped the constraints of gender boxes, that they are themselves put into boxes, is really part of what has been called the colonial project of gender, you know, my thinking in this regard has been really influenced by the Wiradjuri trans non-binary scholar, Professor Sandy O'Sullivan, who's really opened my mind to how our insistence on gendered control is not in any way separate to settler colonialism. It's so completely part of it. So I suppose I've been, you know, on a journey of discovering how much transness is still policed by all these social norms, and trying to push against that, trying to kind of push back against those rules and insist upon the messiness that we all inhabit. But it's a constant struggle because, you know, just to give a really small mundane example, that I, you know, I had to sign up for an account for an internet store today when I was buying something this morning. And, you know, again, I'm forced to say, are you a man or a woman? Like, you know, I could be a trans man or a trans woman, but there's still, you know, we're still constantly being put into boxes all the time. And, you know, out in public, we're always being read as male or female. So I think it's, you know, it's an ongoing process. It's a struggle. And in many ways, lockdown has been a weird kind of reprieve from that struggle, because I'm kind of been apart from, you know, the world. I'm not being gendered. I'm not interacting with as many bodies in a daily basis. I've just been, you know, in my apartment by myself with my cats for most of the last 2 years, which in some ways has been very isolating, but it's also kind of created a kind of sacred space to, you know, borrow Madeline's language of the sacredness of everyday life, in which I can really grow into my gender and explore what that looks like for me, kind of free from all these rules and these transcripts.
And Madeline, in terms of these norms, I'm sorry, I realize I've been foisting identity labels on both of you, outing you, if you apologies for foreground, but you know, this is what we're here for. We're asking the tough questions. But as a neurodiverse person, how have you navigated or confronted these types of norms or scripts?
Yeah, it's been a fascinating process of like embracing neurodiversity and autism and then wanting to break free from it basically immediately. It was like, yes, this makes sense. All the, you know, all the dots join, and then, but I'm more than that label, that word. I mean, and then I realized how you could apply that to just about any label put on anything ever. It's like, well, the thing is not the label. The thing is more than the label, or like signifier and signified. And it's like, it can become like very trippy, and it's an interesting process that I went through in discovering my own autistic nature, which kind of paralleled writing the book, because I didn't realize initially that she was autistic. And obviously autism isn't mentioned in the book at all. Many isms are not mentioned, like feminism, mysticism, veganism, colonialism, environmentalism. There are so many isms that are just not there. And I knew from the beginning of writing it, even before I knew that she had a kind of a neurodiverse mind like mine, that she wasn't interested in the labels. She was just having her experience. You know, she was just either eating a plant-based sort of meal, you know, because she liked the taste and it made her feel good, and, oh, there's her cat, and that makes her feel, you know, like, oh, I don't really want to eat anything like my cat, so great. There's no need to put like a label on that. Like, she wouldn't be thinking about the fact that that's a vegan choice, like, all day, every day. I don't think we do that. Like, I mean, maybe some people do, I'm not sure. But then to discover my own autistic nature kind of alongside writing it was fascinating, and going through the, you know, the assessment, the diagnostic, you know, assessment process and experiencing that, because that's like another, it's like a parallel universe. It's like, it's amazing how we can sort of become fragmented by all the different experiences of this one thing. And that was one facet. But then there was also the day where I was then sitting outside. It must have been 3 or 4 months after I received the official diagnosis and all the papers and all the things. And I'd been, you know, writing and kept writing and hadn't sort of joined any dots. And I was sitting outside and having a cup of tea and sort of looking at the birds. And I was like, well, this is interesting, because if I'm writing a book from inside, you know, this woman's mind, and I'm using the way that my mind is structured to sort of shape her perception of things and her reality, and if I've just been told that my way of shaping and perceiving things is neurodiverse, like, does that mean she is? And I was like, whoa, I think she's autistic too. And it was like this kind of lightning bolt moment, or it was more tender than that, because it was like I'd been chosen by her, because she's so like joyous and kind of shameless and clear about what she wants and what she doesn't want and her space, and then what she does to enter into the public sphere and how fabulous she wants to be, but then how to keep in that fabulousness. Like, there was just so much about her I just thought was extraordinary. So this idea that autism or neurodiversity was absolutely magical, and like that others could draw nourishment from no matter who they were, because I also have this belief that, or I've discovered that neurodiversity to me kind of represents the heightened sensitivities of everybody else. Like, neurodiverse people are just what's kind of unconscious in everybody brought conscious and like amplified. So when we go into a neurodiverse experience, you'll often, like, I notice, and I think people will often see aspects of themselves that they hadn't sort of stopped to like observe, you know, whether it's, I don't know, wow, this space is really overstimulating, hate the fluorescent lights, wouldn't mind everything slowing down, wouldn't mind doing one thing at a time. And it's like, oh, maybe everybody can relate to these things. It's not just an autistic thing, or a, you know, it's a human thing. And I think probably underneath all of the labels ultimately, or maybe beyond the labels, is, you know, a sense of humanity that actually unites us all, but we're all grappling with these different boxes and categories at the same time. And it's like people, you know, like us are really, really in the mud, you know, going hard with what that means.
On this idea of being beyond categories, maybe Eve, I'd like to invite you to do a quick reading now from a book that is about challenging labels and categories.
My pleasure. I'm going to do a brief reading from a chapter called Screen Time, which is about representation of transness on screens and in media generally, as the name suggests. For me, being trans is inseparable from seeing trans, by which I mean the representation of trans people in film, television, and other media defined my understanding of what trans was and whether being trans was thinkable for me. You can't be what you can't see, so the saying goes. For most of my life, I couldn't be trans because I couldn't see any trans people. There were only the freaks depicted in Ace Ventura and the like. Those trans characters were not really people. They were laughable deviants, not fully fledged members of the human race. I, however, was human. I was a human person who wished to be accepted and loved by other humans. So I couldn't possibly be trans. End of story. A common misconception is that real trans people insist upon their transness from earliest childhood. If I was really trans, so the logic goes, I would have refused dresses at 3 years old. I would have screamed whenever the Christmas wrapping paper revealed a Barbie or baby born. I would have demanded short hair and refused to answer to Annie. I didn't do any of those things, so my transness becomes suspect. Surely, if it was real, it would have shown up long before adulthood. Surely you would have told your parents you weren't a girl. You didn't, so are you actually trans at all? But the truth is, for me, as a child, being trans simply wasn't thinkable because transness equaled subhumanity. Children are wily creatures who go to great lengths to survive, even if it means denying their true nature. I learnt young that transness was a fate worse than death. The logical next step was to banish transness from the realm of what was possible. There was no conscious act of repression. I was simply unable to associate my own humanity with the supposed inhumanity of trans bodies. The two just couldn't go together. It was as unimaginable as calling myself a tree or a teapot. Stop there.
This phrasing, not thinkable, is really riveting to me, because it actually captures and highlights the ways in which language is at the heart of, you know, and sure, representations as well, but language is at the heart of the way we conceive of reality and therefore ourselves. And so I mean, we're moving definitely now into the third section, propulsion, aka the worlds. There's just no way to make it alliterative. Place, oh, it's not the same. Propulsion. So I'm really interested in this idea of, or like this conception of writers kind of almost as world builders, you know, or, you know, almost wizards that can create alternative worlds and futures. And, you know, the number of things we've talked about being beyond labels and finding ourselves not quite belonging, or the world not giving us a space to belong. Maybe Madeline, starting with you, would you say that was something you set out to do in, you know, in the writing of this book and your work generally? And why is it important for us to create these stories and create these our own versions of scripts to allow ourselves to be thinkable?
Yeah, I didn't set out to do that, to explore that, but it became part of it, or it was born through what was coming through, I guess, this kind of, and it was all guided by an intuitive sense of what felt right to her and what she would be putting her attention on or not at any given time. But that, yeah, I'm really interested in that idea of the thinkable and the unthinkable, because the whole book is inside her mind. So everything that we're seeing or invited inside has to be inside what's thinkable for her. I guess then the reader would have a relationship with what she's thinking that can't be controlled. Every reader would have a different experience of what she's thinking that can have all different dimensions to it. But then it was really interesting to me when someone else would come into her orbit and they would ask a question about something or have a way of seeing things, and it would then force her attention or her thinking to move somewhere else. And then I would like to think that then the reader's understanding of her would become expanded through this other person kind of coming in and having a question and then forcing her to look elsewhere. And then all of a sudden this whole other world opens up. So I guess, yeah, that was a huge guiding principle in writing it in the end, but it wasn't something that I set out to do. I'm not sure if I'm even answering the question.
No, it's definitely very real.
Multifaceted question. All your questions are like diamonds with all these different sides. Like, which side am I going to
pick? Thank you, but also sorry.
They're all sparkling.
I hope they weren't. I was like trying to make them comprehensible, as is the nature of language.
Oh, they are. Yeah.
But I guess
it's like a treasure chest.
Kind of the other point, the second half of that question, I suppose, is why is hashtag own voices writing important, I suppose.
Ah, yes.
Especially for you as a fiction writer.
Well, I guess because it's like an invitation to break convention or to break expectation or to break and to create something new and beautiful and to feel that you have, I guess, is it a right or a choice to do that, and that there's a sense of value in doing that, and that you don't have to go by what the teacher said, basically, if you don't want. You've got to, if you listen to your heart and your mind, you have your own thoughts and your own inherent structure and your own inherent preferences. And if you listen to those, then something will be born that has its own heartbeat, I guess. So if own voices people can really take up that space and appreciate their value, then, yeah, whole worlds open up for everybody, I would think. Yeah.
And on this idea of language being a container for us and being both limiting but also having potential on one hand, and then on the other hand, the importance of intersubjectivity, so other people chatting with us and being part of our lives. Yeah, Eve, how do you think language can capture us in both senses of the word?
Yeah, I love the way you've used the word capture there in relation to language, because it's really captures that double meaning, or the multiple meanings on which language operates. You know, as I've gestured towards earlier in this conversation, I came to my transness late because I didn't have the language. You know, I grew up in Newcastle in the 90s and the early 2000s. It was a really, you know, had great beaches, but it was a really socially conservative, white, cisnormative, heteronormative place. And, you know, like most of the world was at that time, but I think Newcastle to a heightened extent. And, you know, I really, I suppose, experienced a lack of language around gender and around queerness to be a real barrier to coming into my identity, and discovering language around, you know, concepts like gender dysphoria and gender euphoria and transition and gender affirmation in my late 20s were all, it was revelatory for me. It really gave me, they felt like really powerful tools to unlock a whole new way of living in the world and a whole new future for myself. They enabled me, those words enabled me to imagine a new future. But I suppose I'm, you know, so even though language for me kind of started to have this liberatory potential, I remain really conscious of the way in which our language is very cisnormative, it's very binary, and the way in which everyday speech and language still erases trans people and neurodiverse people and all sorts of minoritized people. I think for me, writing this book was really an attempt to, I suppose, weaponize language to refuse erasure, to kind of insist on the reality of a non-binary life like my own. And even though, you know, things like instruments of the state, like, you know, the recent 2021 census, the language of that refuses to acknowledge the existence of people like me. And even though, you know, the kind of bureaucratic state language is a form of power against me, that I can use that same technology of language to speak back and enhance my own liberation and hopefully the liberation of other trans people.
Such a powerful, formidable mission you've got there, both of you, and incredibly rich.
just a small goal.
Incredibly rich with potential for us to talk about. But we are now approaching the end of our conversation. And so on a final note in this section about the world isn't full of just humans, but also animals. And both of your books, very cutely, and I love ending on this topic, animals are central in the narratives, not just for the characters, but also in terms of conveying a particular kind of empathy, you know, almost like modeling for the readers. So in A Room Called Earth, there is the narrator's pet cat named beautifully Porkchop. And Eve, in All About Eve, there's particularly towards the end that discussion of adopting a lockdown cat and, you know, cats going through the screen, interrupting Zoom conversations. I don't know, like, so maybe Madeline, in the book, in the novel, there's a quote that I love that says, I'm more at ease with the animal part of myself than the human part of myself. What is it about, you know, animals? What makes them so special to humans?
They tap into something so primal and unconditional, a like nonverbal love and acceptance that's like expansive beyond any sort of human constructs or confines or all the language that we've been, you know, relishing in and looking at from all different angles. Animals can just be, and that's perfect. And to have that mirrored back, I think, is one of the most precious experiences that human beings can have. And I would hope that a reader can then, through our books, you know, access to. But I think the animals in my life have certainly highlighted for me a style of loving and relating that is beyond a lot of the crap that I guess human beings seem to put in the way of connecting and feeling at peace being on the earth, just period. You know, animals just have innate access to that. So if you can, yeah, explore and celebrate that, hopefully everybody can get a taste of what it's like to just be together.
What about for you, Eve?
Yeah, I completely agree with everything Madeline said. I, you know, animals, I feel like they see our soul or our essence, like remove, you know, apart from all the labels we've been talking about and the like power relations and forms of othering and oppression, they connect to who we really are. And then in doing that, they give us the freedom to be seen and loved for who we really are. You know, for so long, I often found relating to other humans very stressful because it felt like such a gendered performance. You know, how masculine, how feminine do I have to be? How non-binary do I even have to be? And what does that even mean? Like, how do you express non-binary gender? And there was just so much angst wrapped up in those kind of negotiations. And I love that, you know, I feel like my animals just couldn't give a crap about that. They just care about whether I'm going to pat them and give them food. And you know, and stroke their warm tummies. And that kind of unconditional love, I think, really opened the door to giving unconditional love to myself and seeing my, you know, my body, myself, that had been called deviant and freakish and other, to see it as a lovable, worthy thing. And so I'm very, very indebted to my cats for that.
Very, very cute. Well, from learning to just be, to, you know, the process of constant becoming, to finding and carving out spaces for belonging and love, we've covered so much ground, and I feel like we could keep going for another 7 hours, and I would not be averse to that. But alas, it is now the end of our conversation. So I'd like to thank you both again for being so generous and engaging and entertaining too. So fun. I cannot wait for the world, if they haven't already, to check out your books. A reminder that you can purchase both A Room Called Earth and All About Eve via the Melbourne Writers Melbourne Writers Festival's bookshop partner, Readings. So many S's there. S's, not my strong point. Thank you again to you both, and thank you to the Melbourne Writers Festival for having us. Thank you to the listeners for tuning in, and have a good day or night, whatever the time is.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.